Extra.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
And now on 4 Extra, Just Kids, the memoirs of the American singer-songwriter, poet and artist Patti Smith. And in this final episode, she recalls the day she heard bad news about her former lover and soulmate, the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe.
Robert was diagnosed with AIDS at the same time I found I was carrying my second child. It was 1986, late September, and the trees were heavy with pears. I felt ill with flu-like symptoms, but my intuitive Armenian doctor told me that I wasn't sick, but in the early stages of pregnancy. "What you have dreamed for has come true," he told me. Later, I sat amazed in my kitchen and thought it was an auspicious time to call Robert. Fred and I had begun work on the album that would become Dream of Life, and he suggested that I ask Robert to photograph me for the cover. I hadn't seen or spoken with him for some time. I sat to ready myself, contemplating the call I was about to make when the phone rang. I was so focused on Robert that for an instant I felt it could be him. But it was my friend and legal counselor, Ina Maybach. She told me she had some bad news, and I sensed immediately that it was about Robert. He was in the hospital with AIDS-related pneumonia. I was stunned. I drew my hand instinctively to my belly and began to cry. Every fear I had once harbored seemed to materialize with the suddenness of a bright sail bursting into flames. My youthful premonition of Robert crumbling into dust returned with pitiless clarity. I saw his impatience to achieve recognition in another light, as if he had the predisposed lifeline of a young pharaoh. I manically busied myself with small tasks, thinking of what to say, when instead of calling him at home to speak of working together again, I had to phone him at a hospital. To pull myself together, I decided to first call Sam Wagstaff. Though I hadn't talked to Sam in some years, it was as if no time had passed, and he was happy to hear from me. I asked after Robert. "He's very sick, poor baby," Sam said, "but he's not as bad off as me." In his typical Sam way, he said he found the disease that was mercilessly attacking him on all fronts most annoying. Though I was heartbroken that Sam too was suffering, just hearing his voice gave me the courage to make the second call. When Robert answered the phone, he sounded weak, but his voice strengthened as he heard the sound of mine. Even though so much time had passed, we were as we always had been, breathlessly finishing one another's sentences. "I'm going to beat this thing," he told me. I believed him with all my heart. "I will see you soon," I promised. "You made my day, Patty," he said as he hung up the phone. I can hear him saying that. I can hear it now. As soon as Robert was well enough to leave the hospital, we made plans to meet. Fred packed up his guitars and we drove with our son Jackson from Detroit to New York City. We checked into the Mayflower Hotel and Robert came to greet us. He was wearing his long leather coat and he looked extremely handsome, though a bit flushed. He pulled my long braids, calling me Pocahontas. The energy between us was so intense that it seemed to atomize the room, manifesting an incandescence that was our own. Robert and I went to see Sam, who was in the AIDS ward at St. Vincent's Hospital. Sam, of the hyper-alert mind, glowing skin and hard body, lay there more or less helpless, slipping in and out of consciousness. He was suffering with carcinoma, and his body was covered with sores. Robert reached to hold his hand, and Sam drew it away. "Don't be silly," Robert admonished him, and gently took it in his. I sang Sam the lullaby that Fred and I had written for our son. I walked with Robert to his new loft, a spacious studio in an Art Deco building on 23rd Street, only two blocks from the Chelsea. He was optimistic and certain he would survive, satisfied with his work, his success, and his possessions. "I did all right, didn't I?" he said with pride. I panned the room with my eyes. His desk for me was the crown of his possessions. Designed by Gio Ponti, it was crafted of blonde, burl walnut with a cantilevered writing surface. Compartments lined in zebra wood were outfitted like an altar with small talismans and fountain pens. Above the desk was a gold and silver triptych with the photograph he had taken of me in 1973 for the cover of White. He had chosen the one with the purest expression, reversing the negative and creating a mirror image with a violet panel in the center. Violet had been our color, the color of the Persian necklace. "Yes," I said, "you did well." In the weeks to come, Robert photographed me several times. In one of our last sessions, I wore my favorite black dress. He handed me a blue morpho butterfly mounted on a glass-headed dressmaker's pin. He took a color Polaroid. Everything read black and white, offset by the iridescent blue butterfly, a symbol of immortality. As he had always been, Robert was excited to show me his new work. Large platinum prints on canvas, the image of Thomas and Dovana, a nude black man in a dance embrace with a woman in a white gown. We stood before a work that had just arrived in the frame he had designed. Thomas in an Olympic bend within a black circle above a leopard skin panel. "It's genius, isn't it?" he said. The tone of his voice, the familiarity of the words of that particular exchange took my breath away. "Yes, it's genius." As I resumed the pattern of my daily life in Michigan, I found myself yearning for Robert's presence. I missed us. The phone, which I normally shunned, became our lifeline and we spoke often, though at times the calls were dominated by Robert's mounting cough. On my birthday, he expressed concern for Sam. On the 14th of January, I received a distraught call from Robert. Sam, his sturdy love and patron, had died. They had weathered painful shifts in their relationship and also the critical tongues and envy of others, but they could not stem the tide of the terrible fortune that befell them. Robert was devastated by the loss of Sam, the bulwark of his life. Sam's death also cast a shadow on Robert's hopes for his own recovery. To comfort him, I wrote the lyrics and Fred the music to Pass the Cross, a sort of Sufi song in memory of Sam. Though Robert was grateful for the song, I knew one day I might seek out these same words for myself. Paths the cross will cross again. We returned to New York on Valentine's Day. Robert was occasionally feverish and suffering recurring stomach disorders, yet he was extremely active. I spent most of the following days recording with Fred at the Hit Factory. We were on a tight schedule as my pregnancy was becoming more pronounced and it was getting difficult to sing. I was due at the studio when Robert called in great distress to tell me that Andy Warhol was dead. "He wasn't supposed to die," he cried out, somewhat desperately, petulantly, like a spoiled child. But I could hear other thoughts racing between us. "Neither are you. Neither am I." We didn't say anything. We hung up reluctantly. It was snowing as I passed a churchyard enclosed by an iron gate. I noticed I was praying to the beat of my feet. I hurried on. It was a beautiful evening. The snow, which had been falling lightly, now fell with great force. I wrapped my coat about me. I was in my fifth month, and the baby moved inside me. It was warm and glowing in the studio. Richard Soul, my beloved pianist, left his post to make me coffee. The musicians assembled. It was our last night in New York until the baby came. Fred spoke a few words concerning Warhol's passing. We recorded Up There, Down There. In the center of the performance, I held the image of a trumpeter swan, the swan of my childhood. I slipped outside into the night. The snow had ceased falling, and it seemed like the whole of the city, in remembrance of Andy, had been covered in an undisturbed layer of snow. White and fleeting as Warhol's hair. We were all reunited in Los Angeles. Robert, who was visiting his youngest brother, Edward, decided to shoot the cover there, while Fred and I worked to complete the album with our co-producer, Jimmy Iovine. Robert was pale, and his hand shook as he set up to take the portrait before a cluster of drying palms in the full sun. When he dropped his light meter, Edward knelt to pick it up. Robert was not feeling well, but somehow he marshaled his energies and took the picture. Within that moment was trust, compassion, and our mutual sense of irony. He was carrying death within him, and I was carrying life. We were both aware of that, I know. It was a simple photograph. My hair is braided like Frida Kahlo's. The sun is in my eyes, and I am looking at Robert, and he is alive. Later that evening, Robert attended the recording of the lullaby Fred and I had written for our son Jackson. It was the song I had sung to Sam Wagstaff. There was a nod to Robert in the second verse, "Little Blue Star That Offers Light." He sat on a couch in the control room. Richard Soul was at the piano. I was facing him. We were recording it live. The baby moved within me. Richard asked Fred if he had any special orders. "Make them cry, Richard," was all he said. We had one false start, then put everything we had into the second take. As I finished, Richard repeated the final chords. I looked through the glass window into the control room. Robert had fallen asleep on the couch, and Fred was standing alone, weeping. On June 27, 1987, our daughter Jessie Paris Smith was born in Detroit. A double rainbow appeared in the sky, and I felt optimistic. On All Souls Day, ready to finish our postponed album, we once again packed up the car and, with our two children, drove to New York. On the long drive, I thought of seeing Robert and pictured him holding my daughter. Robert was celebrating his 41st birthday in his loft with champagne, caviar, and white orchids. That morning I sat at the desk in the Mayflower Hotel and wrote him the song Wild Leaves, but I did not give it to him. Though I was trying to write him an immortal lyric, it seemed all too mortal. Some days later, Robert photographed me wearing Fred's flight jacket for the cover of our projected single, People Have the Power. When Fred looked at the photograph, he said, "I don't know how he does it, but all his photographs of you look like him." Robert was eager to take our family portrait. On the afternoon we arrived, he was well-dressed and gracious, though he often left the room, overtaken by a wave of nausea. I watched helplessly as he, always stoic, minimized his suffering. He only took a handful of photographs, but then again, that's all he ever needed. Animated portraits of Jackson, Fred and me together, the four of us, and then right before we left, he stopped us. "Wait a minute. Let me take one of you and Jesse." I held Jesse in my arms, and she reached out to him, smiling. "Patty," he said, pressing the shutter. "She's perfect." It was our last photograph.
Just Kids was read and written by Patty Smith and abridged by Jeremy Osborne. It was a Sweet Talk production for the BBC. Taking its place next week, the thrilling story of the contest to uncover the planet's most elusive secret in Tim Giel's biography of the explorers of the Nile.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
This is Joanna Pinnock. Hello, it's 3 o'clock to drama and tragedy next as Jude's life continues to unravel spectacularly in Jude the Obscure.